ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Remember that Black Mirror episode where you're scored on what kind of citizen you are? For renters, that already exists. Real estate platforms are now collecting up to 50 points of data on anyone who wants to rent a home. I'm Ray Johnston, and on Download This Show, I'm investigating what rental tech is doing to your chances of finding somewhere to live. To hear the series, search Download This Show on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Late Night Live, coming to you from Gadigal land. I'm David Marr. The names our parents give us can be bad enough. I mean, what were they thinking? But nicknames can be so much harder to live with. For a world first on Late Night Live, we turn to music to explain nicknames, how we get them and how they stick. Andrew Ford of The Music Show reckons it's largely about the minor third. That's later. When Israel announced no further action would be taken over the slaughter in Gaza 2 years ago of Zomi Frankum and her colleagues from World Central Kitchen, the Israeli ambassador to Australia claimed a court had cleared the IDF, but that's not so. Later we'll be looking at calls for the expulsion of Ambassador Hillel Newman. But first, Anna Henderson, chief political correspondent of SBS to make sense of Canberra. Anna, welcome to the show.
David, I feel like our discussion just in the last couple of weeks around immigration was very timely. I look forward to trying to make some sense of this with you.
Well, here's my question. What's in a nom?
You know, I think as I said a few weeks ago, there was a time when this Labor government earlier in its time in office in the first term was telling me you can't use levers to change NOM. It's not easily movable. And suddenly we're all now at this point where every political party is tying itself to the net overseas migration number. It's quite extraordinary. And what is in a NOM? Well, I think at this point, you know, One Nation's credibility is on the line a little bit here, because Pauline Hanson has been saying throughout her time as leader of One Nation, but very much while she's had the extra power and the polling boost that's been surrounding her in the past few months, that they will be the very tough on migration party. And then David Farley, her freshly elected lower house MP, has done this extraordinary interview with ABC where he has said, actually, once you change the definition of net overseas migration, which is what we want to do, and you carve out all these groups that we don't think we can change because they're needed to, make sure the economy keeps kicking on and working holidaymakers and farm workers, etc., that the number could actually be higher than what Labor is aiming for in the next 2 years, at 230,000 when Labor's hoping for 225. So we find ourselves in a strange situation. Pauline Hanson has since taken to social media to say that that was wrong, that he was incorrect, that they are absolutely looking to dramatically reduce the migration number under One Nation. Barnaby Joyce says everyone makes mistakes. But if this was a mistake, it certainly went for a long time. The conversation on that insider's couch went for a significant period of time. And David Spears and David Farley talked about all the calculations, yep, and came to a number. And I find it very hard to work out how David Farley and Pauline Hanson are at such odds.
Well, Anna, it seems that at least Pauline Hanson is now admitting that there's the NOM, the net overseas migration, and then there's other. And that's basically what Farley was saying. Farley was putting it at 100,000 extra. Now, Pauline is saying there's extra too, but she's not saying how much extra.
And we could get to a position where, you know, the numbers all start to be quite similar, even if we're not looking at it on quite the level that David Farley was expecting, but there is some extra that One Nation is conceding they would like to see included. We may get up to sort of around the 180,000 a year mark, which is what the opposition's been talking about. And then the 225, yes, it's another leap, but it's not a significant leap of comparative numbers when I speak to a number of analysts about this. I think it is all very confusing, though, for not only for the public, but also for members of these political parties as they try to prosecute their own policy.
But this is One Nation's signature policy. It's the core claim that they're going out there to the electorate and saying, these migrants are causing, you know, everything from, you know, higher prices for Weet-Bix down to marriage breakups, and we're going to reduce the number, and they can't even get this right. So how can they be given credit for any of the policies that they're now pushing?
Look, it is worth mentioning that on the website for some time now, there's been talk of a 130,000 person cap on their migration policy for One Nation, but it has never really been drilled into what that cap actually related to. And so I think One Nation appears to have kept the details very loose for some time, perhaps while it sort of works out where its policy actually lands. Quite seriously, perhaps this was all a process underway to try and work out how to land on a particular number. It's also true, though, that One Nation is trying to become a party that is seen by potentially business leaders as worth investing in, you know, donating to, potentially backing candidates, etc. So it is possible that in that process, One Nation has started to realise that if it massively shrinks migration, that's going to put the party at loggerheads of some of the business interests it's trying to court, because they will be very worried about what a One Nation migration policy means for productivity in the economy.
And maybe David Farley has been around for a while, understands in his heart of hearts that we actually need migrants. do you think he's a stayer? Does David Farley look to you like a stayer in One Nation?
I don't know what his long-term prospects of remaining with the party will be. I know there's been a lot of conjecture about, you know, whether or not many look at what he stands for. He's actually more of a good fit with the Nationals. And we know that he did look around at different political parties before he settled on One Nation. There is a fascinating story in the Nine newspapers this afternoon about him, according to the report, stumbling into a meeting of Liberals during the last sitting week of Parliament and making a joke about whether he might consider joining them at some point. He says it was just a quip. It was just a joke. But in this environment, I think there's a lot of scrutiny. And what did he say? I could see myself sitting here.
Yes.
But I think those things do cause a little ripple of concern within One Nation, because, you know, they would not want to have a situation where they lose him. He is their first elected member to the lower house. And if they want to give off the impression and quell any concerns in the electorate that they are a grown-up party and that they can hold on to their members, which has always been an issue for One Nation over time, they would not want to lose David Farley for him to become an independent or move to a different political party. That would be very disadvantageous to what they're trying to build ahead of the next election.
Yes. Now, Anna, the people of Western Australia must be enormously relieved that the Prime Minister has kind of gone down on all fours, kissed the ground, and absolutely proclaimed that they will continue to get the GST boondoggle that Morrison has given them. Why won't Labor face the fact that this is a very expensive bit of sort of electoral bribery and fix it?
Can I just put it a different way? Because I was having a little look at the WA government's website and how they, you know, frame up this issue. And according to the WA Labor government, although the guarantee that was signed by the Morrison government back in 2018 has cost the Commonwealth more than originally forecast, higher company tax revenue associated with strong iron ore prices has more than offset this cost. So just to let you know what those in WA are arguing, they still think that the company tax revenue from the strong iron oil price means that they're not even getting as much as they deserve. But as for this issue, the Prime Minister can't be seen to be reneging on promises, particularly at the moment. I mean, there's only so much capital they can expend on this front, and the negative gearing, capital gains tax stuff from the budget was obviously a big decision to make. But these kinds of, as expensive as they are, these promises that Anthony Albanese has made, including, you know, using a Sharpie to sign someone's arm, confirming there will be no change, where did he have to go? Even if the Productivity Commission, as the interim report suggests, will end up absolutely recommending that change happens, it won't happen, the Prime Minister said today, while he is in the top job. And I don't think politically he would want to see the kind of blowback in WA that would come from that. Not that I think this is necessarily directly linked, but it is interesting that he's gone to WA just before a local by-election there in a place called Secret Harbour in the WA Parliament. And there's a One Nation candidate running, and a Labor member is left, and so there's a new candidate there for Labor. Just interesting timing. But yes, also, like, the Prime Minister is very aware of the importance of holding onto seats in WA, and that, you know, that part of the country can feel a bit cut off, and there's always, you know, yep, naturally talk about whether WA should run its own fiefdom.
But how much is it going to cost, Anna?
Well, it's billions and billions of dollars.
Yes, it's $60 billion to 2030, when it's supposed to run out. So the West Australia has had 8 consecutive budget surpluses and a $60 billion underwrite to 2030. And Labor has 11 of the 16 seats. It would look like a fairly strong position, but, you know, obviously it's not going to happen. And what do you reckon the chances of it ending in 2030 are?
Well, what do you think are the chances of Anthony Albanese running for another term? I think that there is obviously a frustration, you know, a hard-headed economic frustration around this, and a lot of East Coast premiers are pretty frustrated with how this has unfolded. But the reality is, when the Prime Minister decided that he wanted to woo WA voters, he made a decision, and it's a very expensive decision for him, and he'll get no end of consternation from those in the East Coast premier's chairs, and he'll hear that next week, because I think, or maybe it's even this week. It is this week. They're having a meeting very soon, a national cabinet type meeting, and in that kind of engagement, no doubt they will voice their concerns loud and clear.
It's the first show of the week, and the first person we speak to every week is Anna Henderson, Chief Political Correspondent of SBS, to explain Canberra to the nation. Now, Christ has been awfully busy lately, hasn't he, in the electoral scene? ICAC in New South Wales is investigating the role of a radical bunch of Catholics who were branch stacking. And meanwhile, there have been fresh revelations about the work that the Plymouth Brethren have put in to try to get the coalition re-elected federally. Now, what's going on there?
Well, the first thing for me to say about this story is that it's come from reporting from the 9 newspapers, and it's not reporting that I have been able to independently verify, but I think it's worth framing up, because this is what the Prime Minister has been responding to and what the church has been responding to as well. But essentially, the allegation raised is that elders within the Plymouth Brethren had paid money to far-right activists to disrupt the Labor federal election campaign appearances. So pretty extraordinary allegation, and one that they've got sources that they refer to explain how that happened. This story came out at the end of last week, and it came out on the morning of, and this is surely not a coincidence, the morning that the Brethren's representative, Lloyd Grimshaw, the director at that organisation, which is a charity, appeared before a parliamentary committee. And during that hearing, which went for 3 hours, it was a really significant period of time that he was being questioned by the politicians. He said that he firstly rejected that claim completely, that that any members of the church.
It wasn't the church. It wasn't the church. Maybe members of the church, but it wasn't the church.
But let's go to that because, very, very specifically in that evidence he gave, it was his evidence that the Plymouth Brethren Church had not paid any money, donated money, or had in an organised way arranged for members of the fellowship to go out and advocate for the Liberal Party. We do know, though, that members of the Brethren were wearing Liberal Party shirts, and there are allegations raised by local members that some were flown in or bussed into different electorates.
This was on polling. Yeah, this was on polling day, yeah. Wasn't it? Yeah.
Yes. They were flown out and they were there to kind of bolster the Liberal...
man the booths.
Like had a vote card. Yeah, exactly.
Man the booths.
And so this is something that was, and in the pre-polling as well, it wasn't just on kind of election day, but it was in the lead-up as well. So there was this concern raised about how, whether or not, a charity, an organisation with charity status in Australia was actually directing organising members to go out and do this for a political party, and whether that constituted potentially a donation to a political party, which would be a massive issue for a charity. They're not supposed to, well, then allowed to donate.
So, Anna, so the leader of the church is there being quizzed by this committee, and did the coalition members of the committee really grill him?
Well, they felt like the whole thing was a witch hunt,
yeah.
and they felt like he was unfairly treated, and that they spent too much time questioning him, and they sent out a media release very soon afterwards. Yeah, a hyper-partisan witch hunt is how they described it. But at the same time, the Lloyd Grimshaw did not deny that groups of members of the Brethren went out and manned the booths. He didn't deny that they did that. He just said it wasn't in an organised way through the Plymouth Brethren, and if they, through their family networks, decided they wanted to go out and support Liberal candidates in line with their conservative values, what would be wrong with that? So it is a committee that is now going to go through a process of, deciding on its recommendations, and I'm sure we haven't heard the last of this issue, but they very strongly denied the claim that in some way the church had paid money to these far-right influences. But today the Prime Minister, when he was asked about that story, he certainly has taken up this cause. In the election campaign, he called the Brethren a cult, which they absolutely say is an unfair characterisation. And he today went right into the accusations of saying that they were, according to the reports, involved with, neo-Nazis and with people being paid to disrupt an election campaign. And that's, in his view, a really serious and problematic issue and a very dangerous issue. So I think this Labor membership on this electoral matters parliamentary inquiry will no doubt be digging into this further in their final report.
And it's worth noting that the reporting in the Nine newspapers is by Michael Batchelard, an expert on cults generally, but also in particular on the Plymouth Brethren Christian Church. Anna, thanks so much for joining us again on Late Night Live. Talk to you next week.
Thank you, David.
Coming up, the work of the Israeli ambassador in Australia.
I don't support breaking diplomatic relations with Israel. I don't support the closing of embassies. But this bloke is clearly an unacceptable representative so far as Australia is concerned, and he should be sent home.
That's Chris Sidoti, human rights lawyer and member of the United Nations Commission of Inquiry on the Occupied Palestinian Territory and Israel. having something to say about Hillel Neumann, Israel's ambassador to Australia. Neumann has been particularly busy in the aftermath of Israel's refusal to investigate any further the killing by the IDF of the Australian humanitarian worker Zomi Frankum and her colleagues in Gaza a couple of years ago. To discuss Neumann's role in Australia and recent political developments in Israel, we're joined by Iris Mackler, veteran Jerusalem correspondent for ABC and SBS. Iris, welcome back to the show.
Thanks.
Hillel Neumann, ambassador to Australia. Who is he? How does he operate?
Hillel Neumann is a career diplomat, which, given his hard-going style, might surprise some people. You know, Israel and other places, of course, too, does send out political nominees. He's not apparently one of those. So he has been an ambassador many years ago, I think, in one of the stands, worked with the Inside Israel in the Foreign Policy Committee, and has come out here and comes out swinging, comes out fighting on every issue. And there have been a lot in his tenure only since February 2026.
When you say come out fighting, what do you mean?
I mean, he takes Israel's point of view and plays hardball with it. Chris Sidoti describes him as a wolf warrior, not a diplomat, more interested in serving his master's political masters back home than actually dealing with Australians. I don't know if that's a fair comment, but he has got an assertive style for a diplomat. And we could see that because just recently, within the last few days, when he was in Canberra and he was speaking to journalists as he left, you know, he wasn't pleased with how that had gone. And he said, well, what do you think we have to do, lynch people in the street in response to Australians not being happy about the World Central Kitchen, the findings in this case?
When he was talking to those journalists, he made the extraordinary claim that a court had cleared the IDF. Now, that was just bullshit, wasn't it?
It is not a court that's cleared the IDF at all. This was all sent, you know, many cases were sent for an investigation. This is more than 2 years after the events, don't forget, David. And what the military advocate general, basically the military's prosecutor, what they said was certain cases don't have to go any further, a few do, and the World Central Kitchen cases is amongst those that we don't think has to go any further. So there hasn't been a court looking at it, not even a military court, certainly not an independent civilian or judicial inquiry of any kind.
So he was over-egging the pudding there. And is that his style? I mean, is his role really as a spokesman for Israel to the Australian people, so that he's a more of a player than a diplomat?
Perhaps that's how he sees himself, because he one of the reasons that Chris Sidoti is calling for Hillel Neumann to be expelled or to be recalled back home is because he says that he's been interfering in internal political, Australian political matters. And what he was thinking of, I spoke to Chris Sidoti earlier today, and what he was thinking of was Hillel Neumann coming up to the ALP meeting earlier in
the
July,
conference.
The conference in July, and putting forward his views about the ALP, things that are being put as policy in the ALP vis-a-vis Israel-Palestine, and the Israeli ambassador is putting his two cents worth in there. And Chris Sidoti says that's inappropriate. He said if a Chinese ambassador were to do it, there'd be an uproar. But Israel-Palestine being what it is, you know, people do throw their two cents worth in on both sides quite a lot. Is that the job of the Israeli ambassador?
Is it such a problem?
Or is it such a problem?
I mean, we hear the ambassador speaking loud and clear for Israel. Isn't that a plus for us to know what Israel's thinking?
Well, that's one possible view, but Chris Sidoti's view, and he's the one calling for Hillel Neumann to go home, his view is that that's stepping over the line, that the ambassador's strong defence of his country at various points, the World Central Kitchen case, the ALP conference, the incident with the Gaza flotilla, where what Chris Sidoti says of Hillel Newman is that it was also too strong to be criticising those Australians who were on that flotilla. 11 of the 400 people on the flotilla were Australians. They came back and made certain allegations, and Sidoti says that what we heard from the ambassador was criticism of them and a suggestion that they were Hamas supporters, and he says that's inappropriate.
What does it take for the IDF to continue investigating one of their killings?
At this point, I'm not clear. If the military prosecutor says no more investigation, it would have to be some political, I guess, pressure to make them go any further.
So the political pressure from Australia, I mean, the world Central Kitchen cohort all killed, despite their humanitarian job that morning being clearly briefed to the IDF, IDF permission had been given for them to go in, et cetera, et cetera. They were killed. They were Australians, British,
three Brits, an Australian, Canadian, Palestinian, and a Pole.
Right.
I think American Palestinian.
And the three governments, Australia, Britain, Canada, have all protested the refusal to continue investigating. And that's not enough.
Well, it's very recent. It'd be interesting to see what happens next, actually, because in Israeli military terms, the military, just in its internal military terms, the military says there's no evidence of intention. I mean, when you look at all the facts and you see the report of the Australian representative, Mark Biskin, a former member of the Air Force, sent out to investigate at the time, it's a very interesting read. You know, it came out in August 2024. I was reporting on this story then, but I didn't read his report at the time. I have read it now, so thank you for that. But it's an interesting read because it's a bit more nuanced. It's a bit more of a nuanced picture. And he is satisfied that there was no intentional killing. He's not satisfied that there was no... That's right, that there was not reckless or negligent.
I mean, intention is one element of the law, but the other one is reckless indifference.
That's right.
To the outcome.
That's exactly right. Yeah. So what the Israeli military investigation seems to be saying is there was no intention, you know, actual intention, and therefore we'll close the case. Not therefore should we look at negligence or indifference,
but
recklessness.
But other cases, they are continuing to investigate. And, you know, what is it about them that compels Israel to keep investigating?
Those two cases, one, the case of the 5-year-old Hind Rajab, who was...
Oh, my God, that story.
That story, it's so painful.
Sitting in a car, on the telephone, begging for help.
Begging for help, you know, for hours, asking the operator, don't you live near me? Couldn't you come and get me? It's almost unbearable to listen to as a human being listening to a small child. Everyone else in the car killed. They finally do send two paramedics to try to save her, and in the end she and the paramedics are found dead.
Yep.
So that is such an egregious case, as is the killing of the, I think, 15 paramedics in Rafah in the south. Also a case where there was a dispute as to the facts, and then now it is being investigated further and recommended for a prosecution. Interestingly, Chris Sidoti, the UN commission that he sits on, the inquiry into the occupied Palestinian territories, has done a report on both those two cases. So they're large enough for them to transcend every boundary. They were in the media all the time. Not that the World Central Kitchen wasn't, but I think they're so egregious that they must be investigated further.
On ABC Radio National, this is Late Night Live. I'm David Marr, and I'm talking to Iris Mackler, veteran Jerusalem correspondent. We will turn our attention now to the political situation in Israel. Tell us about Gadi Eisenkot.
So Gadi Eisenkot is 65 years old, a little bit older than some of the other people in the race, former military chief of staff, former general, former military secretary to Ehud Barak, if you're going to go back in time in Israeli politics. And he has come out as the head of a party called Yashar, Straight. And he seems to be currently the most popular alternative to Benjamin Netanyahu in Israeli politics. Bit of a surprise because there's other opposition parties, but he's come into the forefront. And within the last 2 months, it was always the Likud party in the lead. And other parties behind. And now for the first time, Gadi Eisenkot's party is in the lead. That doesn't mean what it means in Australia, but it does mean if they're the largest party, then they have the first crack at
forming a government.
Forming a government. It doesn't mean that he will could form a government by himself at all. It would have to be a coalition, as it would have to be for Netanyahu. But what we're seeing for the first time is another party inching in front of Netanyahu's Likud.
He doesn't sound like a peacenik.
No, he's not a peacenik. In fact, he's a centre-right politician. I think we discussed this once before, that the dividing line in Israel now is people who believe in democracy and the rule of law and the country's institutions, and those who don't believe in them or only pay lip service to them, in which category I'd now put Benjamin Netanyahu, you know, who I think, having watched his career for all these years, his own political survival is now more important than many of the country's institutions to him. So I don't think you would say that about Gadi Eisenkot. So even though he's not a peacenik, he does believe in the democratic institutions of the country.
And he would not come entangled with the far, 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 far right, Smotrich, etc., who keep Netanyahu afloat.
Yes, and who they've all started turning their big guns, including all their social media poison machine, as it's called. Everybody's turning it on Eisenkot, which is a sign, I think, of the fact that he is actually a danger to them. And that's how they see him. He is a real rival. There's something, he hasn't got that charisma, certainly not the political experience, but nor the charisma that Netanyahu, well, at least had in his earlier days. But he does have that kind of straight shooter, straight talker. There's also the fact that he has lost a son and two nephews in the Gaza war, which to an Israeli public represents a patriotism that they respect.
You mentioned a moment ago alliances. It seems that he would have to form an alliance of other parties. And the question is being raised at the moment whether anyone can rule after these coming elections without an alliance with Arab parties. What would that mean for Israel?
Well, it has happened once before. Mansour Abbas leads the Southern Islamist Party, so-called. He's a most unusual politician and a most unusual man. You know, previously the Arab parties didn't agree to sit in government with Jewish-Israeli parties, even if they were part of the Knesset, the parliament itself. So he broke that rule and he sat with in a government for the short time that Netanyahu wasn't in power, that I think it was 15 months, 18 months that he wasn't in power.
Over the last how many years?
Yes, over the last 20 years.
20-something years, yes.
Yes, but in that short period, there was a government that depended on Mansour Abbas. And he's a very interesting politician. Now, could they sit with him again? Benjamin Netanyahu, who courts Mansour Abbas himself, has courted and perhaps even continues to court Mansour Abbas, was heard spitting about that the only way the opposition to him could survive or could maintain power, could get into power, is with the support of the Islamists. So you can see it's becoming a fault line in this upcoming election. Now just over 2 months away.
But do the Arab parties have policies that would radically change what Israel is currently about in the region? And would they have the leverage to actually change things?
I don't know how to answer that because not all of them would sit in government. So really you're talking, nor would anybody be prepared to sit with some of them. So none of the Israeli parties, the Jewish Israeli parties, might be prepared to sit with them. But we are seeing for the first time in this election suggestions that Jewish politicians will join one of the Arab parties, that Arab politicians might join a Jewish party in a more significant sense than they have in the past when there have been Druze politicians, but not actually Arab politicians. You know, Druze is a minority. They are Arabs, but it's a different game in Israeli politics because they serve in the Israeli military. So you know, will this be a groundbreaking election? Well, it will be a groundbreaking election because it's a referendum on Benjamin Netanyahu after all his years in office and after October the 7th. But will it also be a groundbreaking election because it will introduce Arab politicians or indeed Arab parties into government, despite the fact that everybody is now saying it won't make any difference and, of course, they're unlikely to sit with them? But will that change once they actually have to get to number 61 and make the numbers work?
We're familiar enough in this country with political leaders promising not to form alliances, which suddenly become indispensable when it comes to governing.
Core and non-core promises, I believe they're called.
Ah, yes, I've forgotten about the non-core promises. Mm-hmm. Iris, Israel may be weary of Netanyahu, but is it weary of war? Is the electorate demanding peace or just a different leader?
I think the electorate is weary. It's weary because it's been fighting on the southern front in Gaza, on the northern front in Lebanon, in an international front against Iran, it was very costly in both senses, both for Iran and for Israel, these past two massive offensives. So I think the electorate is weary, but they also fear that things won't change necessarily and that they'll be fighting for a very long time to come.
Is that because they've accepted Netanyahu's argument that Israel is inevitably imperiled and must fight?
I think the impact of October the 7th on the Israeli public has been huge. It's driven the public to the right. Even people who believe in negotiations with the Palestinians were set back by the level of viciousness of the October the 7th attacks, their brutality. And so on that level, what you're seeing is a different electorate. I don't even think they need to hear Netanyahu's arguments to be fearful. I think they're fearful because of what they experienced. Netanyahu is a powerful messenger of fear. That's absolutely true. And if there were other politicians in power, it might be different. You know, I have interviewed very impressive politicians who were also military leaders who are not from Netanyahu's party, who say that fear-mongering of his is actually antithetical to the whole idea of Zionism, which wasn't so fearful in its origins. So, you know, there are other views in the country, and I think that that's why this is a seminal election.
And you're going to be there to report it for us.
I am indeed.
Which we look forward to very much.
Me too.
Iris, thank you once again for joining us on Late Night Live.
Thanks so much.
Coming up, nicknames and the minor third. The other day, the composer Andrew Ford, who presents the music show on this station and has for the last 30 years, turned his attention to the mystery of names, how we get them, how they stick. In a beautiful piece he wrote for Inside Story the other day, he ventured an argument I've never heard before, that there's music to names. So we've dragged him from his studio to ours to explain himself. Andrew Ford, welcome to Late Night Live.
It's lovely to be here, David.
Andrew, or should I call you Andy?
You can call me, I bet you've never been called Dave.
Oh, my friends in ridicule all call me Dave. I'm referred to as Dave.
You don't like it though, I can tell.
Oh, no, you know, affectionate insult.
Okay, right, yeah.
But the other thing is I don't hear it.
No.
You don't hear what you're called.
Oh, I do if someone calls me Andrew, because most people call me Andy. My family call me Andrew. My mother always insists on Andrew. And therefore, you know, I said in the article, when you're in a supermarket or something and you hear the name behind you, if somebody says Andy, you know, they talk to a child or something, I turn around.
You think it's you?
Yeah, but if somebody says Andrew, there's a moment's pause before I turn around and I think, oh, what have I done wrong?
Have I shoplifted something unobtrusively?
Yeah.
Now, your father, growing up in the mean streets of Liverpool, UK, was known by his friends as Alec. But it wasn't just Alec. What was it?
Well, his name was Alexander, and Alexander tended to be shortened to Alec in those days rather than Alex, as it more often is now. They were living in a slum, and there was a back alley, and his friends would come along the back alley calling him out to come and play with them, and they would call, "Now, Alec!" I remember him telling me this, and it was always that calling interval of the falling minor third, which is the interval that we use to call David, or, yeah. You know, it's always that interval.
Because it carries,
yes. And also, I mean, there are kind of physics reasons for it as well in terms of the harmonic series, but we don't need to get bogged down in that. But it's also the interval that gives us na na and na 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 na. That's and it's a kind of universal thing because it's to do with physics.
My mother, when entering the homes of her children, would call out at the door, "Woohoo!"
Yeah.
And her grandchildren ended up calling her "Uhu." She was known as "Uhu." Same third, same.
Yeah, Uh-huh. And that's what you 1960s housewives calling across the fence. "Yoo-hoo." It's Avon calling. Doorbells do that. Dung dungs. Lifts when they arrive do it. So it's the calling interval, and that's why I think perhaps one of the reasons that we get nicknames is because a long name you can't do that to a long name. You can do it to David, you can do it to Andrew, but with Andy it's actually carries slightly better. But I think if you call Alexander, you can't do it, so it has to be shortened to Alex.
Alexander.
Yes. Oh, that's different.
That's different. But of course, what it does is it's absolutely not hostile. If you were just shouting out, "Alec!"
Yes, yes.
It could be hostile.
It could, yes.
But not if it's sung in that way.
No.
You, by that same man, Alec, you were called all your life by him Horace.
Yes, I was.
Now, there's... Explain.
Well, I mean, it wasn't until sort of later in life I actually asked him why he was... He was calling me Horace, and I'd like to say it was because he was a kind of classicist, but he wasn't. It was on radio, and there will be somebody listening who's just about old enough to remember this. There won't be many people. 1930s radio in the UK, there was this fellow whose name I've now forgotten, it's in the article, who had this comedy routine where he played a family. He did all of the voices of this family. He was the father, and there were four children. And one of the children was called Winnie, little girl, and there was a baby called Horace. And he had this catchphrase, because when he did Horace, he sort of did this kind of baby burbling sound. And then he'd say, "What did Horace say, Winnie?" And so when I was a baby, I'm sure I'm not the only person this happened to. When I was a baby, my father would say to my mother, after I'd said something completely unintelligible, "What did Horace say, Winnie?" And Horace stuck. And I, you know, I was 55 when he died, and I was still Horace.
But nobody else could call you Horace.
Oh, nobody else. No.
It's not a... He owned that name, didn't he? Mm. I can't call you Horace. No. That would be really wrong.
Yes, yes.
And there is a way in which... people own a particular name for us.
That's right. And also we own names. I mean, when we're given a name, you know, that moment when you're trying to decide on a name for a baby or a pet, it could be anything. And you narrow it down. And maybe you have the conversation before you get the baby or the pet. And you're not sure. And I mean, we had my daughter's name before she was born. We knew she was a daughter, but we didn't, you know, we hadn't met her, but we had the name. And so she kind of arrived in the world with a name fitted to her. And now, of course, you couldn't call her anything else. You couldn't change it because that's her name. And I'm interested in the way in which names attach themselves to people. Because, you know, there are people, I suppose, who feel they have the wrong name. And there is, occasionally you get people who change their names.
I know the most extraordinary thing. They go into an office somewhere and they change their name. Yeah. Yes.
But on the whole, you know, we kind of fit into, it's a bit like a pair of new shoes, maybe. We kind of break them in, you know, and we get used to the name and the name gets used to us.
You mentioned dogs a moment ago. Mm. You mentioned pets. Just in parentheses, are you as disturbed as I am by the modern habit of putting the dog's name on their harness? Yes.
Yeah, we have not got a harness. We have a harness, but it does not have my dog's name, which is Dora, by the way, is not on the harness. And so, but but down in the dog park, you know.
Yes, there are all their names. And I always look for David, of course, but it's curiously not a name
it's
given
not a
to
dog
dogs.
Name.
It's not a
you
name.
Know, traditionally, and this is Levi Strauss, if you don't mind. This is Late Night Live. We can talk about Levi Strauss.
You bet.
He reckons that we give dogs noble names. This is traditionally, not obviously Dora isn't a particularly noble name, but Fido, Rex, Prince, Sultan, these sorts of names are the names we give to dogs. Whereas we call birds after ourselves. So there's Jenny Wren, Tom Tit, Robin Redbreast, Jim Crow, etc., etc. Isn't that interesting?
It is interesting, and I don't know why, but it makes me think that, curious that men are so rarely named after plants and women so often are.
Oh, yes.
I mean, there's Basil.
Yes.
But you never meet a man called celery or lettuce.
No. But there are women called lettuce.
Yes, of course.
Alan Bennett wrote this thing some years ago about nursing homes and how they are kind of graveyards for names, because, you know, names go in and out of fashion. And so in a nursing home, you find Dorises and Ednas and Berts and Harolds. And he was looking forward to 60 years from now when they're full of Stacys and Madisons and Noahs.
Yes, yes. And Lucas.
Yes.
The place will be packed with Lucas.
Yes.
One of my grandmothers was a Mabel, the other one was an Ivy. Now, you don't hear those names anymore. But then you don't hear David. David has dropped out of the top 100 names. What about Andy?
I don't know.
Don't you keep a check every year? What
does David mean? Does it have a meaning? Because Andrew, it won't surprise you to know, means manly.
David, let me tell you, is a figure in a well-known book called The Bible.
Yes.
Do you remember?
Yeah, Andrew's in there too.
No, not as prominently. David
no,
is
not a king.
David okay. is a hero of the Bible. Now, look, can you fight a nickname successfully? I'm not sure that you can. Do you think you can?
I think it might be that the more you fight it, the more it clings on. I think it depends who's giving you the nickname as well and the reasons. I mean, if they are, as we said earlier, giving you the nickname so they can call you out to play over the backyard wall, that's one thing. But if they're, you know, a lot of nicknames are quite cruel, aren't they?
Oh, yes, of course. Deliberately so. And with great affection, cruel.
Oh, sometimes with great affection, but sometimes not. I'm trying to... you know, and there are words, that also names that I suppose... I mean, I wonder, are there a lot of Adolfs these days?
No, you don't hear a lot of Adolfs. No, you never hear an Adolf. I wonder what names there are on the list of never to be used again.
There might be some, yeah.
There would be others as well.
Yeah.
What about the names that attach to children because in a funny or at the time amusing way, a baby sibling can't pronounce the actual name. So my brother couldn't pronounce the name David, and his garbled attempts to pronounce my name have haunted me now for over 70 years.
Right, so he still calls you that.
Not only him.
Right.
Not only him. But that's a particular
I really want to know, of course, what it is, but you're not going to tell us.
No. But that's a particular class of nickname, and it's unbudgeable.
Yeah.
You experience of them in your family?
Yeah, I had an aunt who was called Edna, who was always known as Nen, because my mother, when she was a small child, couldn't say Edna.
Yes. It's a particularly gorgeous.
Yeah, it is.
It's a particularly gorgeous way of naming people, except for the people who actually have to live with the name.
I think Edna got used to it.
You mention in your essay the extraordinary blindness of parents when naming their own children. I mean, particularly when, in this instance, the surname was Heaven.
Yes, this was the school principal of the neighbouring girls' school when I was growing up, and she was Miss Heaven. And she sort of have a great deal to do with it because she wasn't at my school, but I remember her being rather prim. And it was only later that I discovered that Miss H. Heaven, that her first name was Helen. And you think, these parents have never actually pronounced the name before they settled on the first name. They have never actually said Helen Heaven and realised what they were getting. But that, I suspect, is why she was prim.
I think, though, can't you look at people who have dreadfully difficult names to grow up with and admire them for their courage, admire them for what it does for their characters?
I suppose so. It's like the Shel Silverstein song, the Johnny Cash hit, A Boy Named Sue. I mean, it was the making of him.
What were your nicknames? Come on.
Well, Andy, But
that's pretty white bread.
Pretty boring, I know. The other one I had, and I didn't mention this in the article, but I spent the first 10 years of my life in Liverpool in England before we moved to the outskirts of London. And in Liverpool, and I became Andy after we had moved, but when I was in Liverpool, I was 40.
40, yep.
Yeah, and there is a friend of mine, an Irishman who lives near me in the Southern Highlands, who calls me 40. And I think it might be an Irish thing because, you know, Liverpool's full of Irish people. So I think that kind of... But it's also a very Australian thing and therefore also possibly Irish.
Yes. Is there a wish to put another syllable on one-syllable names? Ford, Ma. Doesn't happen with Ma, but...
No, it's very hard. What could you add to Ma?
Oh, don't ask. Don't don't begin to speculate. Do you agree with me that by the time you've left school, you have heard every joke that can be cracked about your name? There's never, after that, a fresh joke.
You're probably right. I mean, I wonder whether Helen Heaven... ever got used to it or kind of just sort of smiled kind of and said, yes, I know, I have noticed.
Just lived with it.
Yeah.
Which is what we have to do with names.
Yeah. That's what I was saying. We grow into them. They are character forming and we form their characters.
What's the best name in the world these days for a man and for a woman?
Well, I actually did look when I was writing this article to see what was top, and Noah is definitely top for boys. That's why the nursing...
Noah,
I know. Noah. That's why the nursing home's going to be full of them in 60 years. I don't know about girls. What was it? A few years ago, I noticed that Madison was on... It's not there now in the top 20, but it was there twice a few years ago, roughly when our daughter was born, and we were looking out of interest to see what was the common name. And it was there twice because you could spell it with one D or two.
Do you think of women's names as beautiful? I mean, that is a name that means... The holder will be beautiful. Ditto men, of course.
Hmm. Well, I think there are pretty names, aren't there? And my daughter is called Elsie. I mean, that's which is an old-fashioned name. That's a kind of now nursing home name, but it's sort of on the way back. And I think that's a very pretty name. And it used to be one of the many, many shortenings of Elizabeth, but it sort of now is kind of in its own right, I think. And has been for a long time, a name which is, very pretty. But there are the flower names you mentioned, and of which there are so many, mostly European flowers, are
Daisy.
Daisy has connotations, doesn't it? I have a niece called Daisy, great niece actually, and she is such a daisy. I mean, she's exactly what you would. She's kind of big and smiley and noisy and, you know, you wouldn't have a retiring Daisy, I don't think.
That would not be a child living up to the name. No. Look, a scholarly discussion of this kind comes along rarely on Late
Night
Live.
That's right, I'm glad. But this is the only place you could have one of these. And we did get Levi Strauss in, come on.
Yes. No, I'm grateful to that. Thank you effusively once the microphones are turned off. Andy Ford, thank you so much for... joining us on Late Night Live to discuss names and Andrew's essay in Inside
story.
And Andrew's essay, An Inside Story, was published a couple of weeks ago. It's there, exactly. Up on the net, and it's beautiful. This is Late Night Live. And that's the show. Bruce Shapiro is on our next, and I'm not even going to pretend to know what he'll be talking about because it's hours away, and in the United States these days, anything can happen at any time. But we can rely on Shapiro to make sense of it come what may.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.